saw this place. But that's not going to be easy.
Kelton.
Jackie can't drive. Her hands are swollen like balloons. She tries to touch the steering wheel and wails in anguish. Between Alyssa and me, I am the lesser of two evils behind the wheel. She doesn't have her learner's permit yet, but I do. In spite of my father's insistence that I need to earn the right to drive, he's taken me to empty parking lots. According to him, I've totaled about 20 imaginary cars while trying to navigate those lots. Good thing all I have to worry about now are trees. I put the car in gear, with Alyssa beside me. She can work the four-wheel drive stick while I put all of my attention into the normal driving part. We lurch and grind gears. We scrape trees. We bounce violently over rocks. Jackie curses each time she reflexively uses her hands to brace herself. I catch Garrett in the rearview mirror. He doesn't look as terrible as he did before. He just looks bad, like the rest of us. I'm tired now. My lungs burn from the smoke I inhaled at the campsite. Carbon monoxide. It bonds to your red blood cells like oxygen, but unlike oxygen, it doesn't let your blood cells go. They become useless. That's why people die from smoke inhalation. They don't have enough red blood cells left to carry oxygen to the brain. I'm still conscious, so I know however much I breathed in, it's not enough to kill me, but there's plenty of other things lining up to kill me right now, including my own driving. It's so hard to keep my eyes open, but I have to. We come over another ridge and start down a slope, but this slope is steeper than any of the others. I should have been looking at the topography map. I should have known this. "Careful, Kelton," Alyssa says. I hit the brakes and we start to skid. We're at a steep downward grade now, maybe 30 degrees. The wheels barely find traction. The brakes are useless. Nothing's going to slow our descent. I just have to somehow keep us from hitting trees and boulders. "Kelton!" yells Jackie. "You're losing it!" As if I didn't already know. I turn the wheel right. We sideswipe a tree. A sharp turn left. We bounce over a boulder so big I hear it scrape on our underbelly. And as bad as I thought the grade already was, it gets steeper. There's nothing I can do now. Gravity has taken over. I grip the wheel, brace myself. A loud bang. A flash of white. A pain in my gut and chest like I got kicked in the stomach. I gasp. Can't get enough air. Maybe the carbon monoxide got me after all. No, the wind is knocked out of me, that's all. And the airbags have deployed. And we're not moving anymore. "Is everyone okay?" I hear Alyssa say. "No," says Jackie, which is her way of saying yes. Garrett just groans and tells me I suck at driving. I kick open the door. Immediately I smell gasoline. "Careful," I tell everyone. "I think we ruptured the gas tank." We're on a road now. Narrow, poorly maintained, but it's a road. This must be East Fork Road. At least that's something. I walk around the truck, but it's barely walking. My feet are dragging. Everything hurts. My head feels like it's going to crack in half like an egg. I want to lie down so badly, so badly, just for a minute. But I don't, because I know that feeling. I know what that feeling means. The truck is done. It looks like it's been through a demolition derby. One wheel is flat, another one is turned completely sideways. "The reservoir is about a mile that way," I say, pointing west. "We'll have to walk the rest of the way." "I think I can make it," says Garrett, the only one who's had any water in 2 days. But Alyssa and Jackie look at me like I just pronounced a death sentence. Jackie shakes her head. "I don't know if I have a mile left in me, Kelton." "Don't think about it," Alyssa says. "We just walk and keep on walking. Even after we feel like we can't, we just keep on walking." So we stop talking and we start walking. West. And I find myself taking the lead. Because I have a sudden burst of energy.
52. Alyssa.
Walking. Walking. One foot. Then the next. Then the next. I am not alive. I am not dead. I am something in between. Shuffle, shuffle, step, step. How far is a mile? How many steps? It doesn't matter. I can't count. My higher brain functions have mostly shut down. I think about nothing but the water up ahead. I allow it to pull my feet forward. Step, step, shuffle, shuffle. And the others are the same. Kelton is a few feet ahead of us, but I can see the way his feet move, that it's not a normal gait. It's the same dragging shuffle as the rest of us. For a few minutes, it looked like he had his second wind. But he's slowing down. I think we're water zombies now. Smoke pours through the trees, creating a haze in front of us. I start to cough. How much farther? I ask. It barely comes out. It doesn't sound like my voice. No one answers me. My guess is that there's maybe only a quarter mile to go. But the smoke gets denser. Less than a minute later, I see flames up ahead. Is this from the campsite fire, or is it another fire? I don't know why it matters, but somehow it does. Like the flames are driven by the angry spirits of Benji and Kyle and their invalid mother. The fire has already leaped to the other side of the road. Now this narrow road looks like the black tongue of a great beast of fire about to swallow us. Which is worse, I wonder, death by fire or death by thirst? How can you choose the lesser of two evils when both evils are too great to measure? We can't get through, says Kelton. We'll go north, back into the forest, to the right of us. That's away from the water, Jackie says. And from the fire. Kelton responds, we'll go around it and reach the reservoir from the north. But getting around the fire means adding at least another half mile to the journey. We're almost there, says Jackie. I can see the water. I think that must be a hallucination, because when I look into the furnace of the road up ahead, all I see is smoke and flames. I think I can make it, says Jackie. You can't, I tell her. I know it's not what she wants to hear, but you can't fight a wildfire with willpower. You can't intimidate flames. Then behind us, I hear an explosion. A mushroom cloud of black smoke billows into the sky. The truck, says Kelton. There was gasoline pouring from it when we left it. If the fire has crept in behind us and ignited the gas, then we're cut off. There's nowhere for us to go now but up the slope to the right of us, north, around the flames. There's water just ahead, Jackie insists. I know there is. I saw it. She looks to the flames sweeping from tree to tree. You can't outrun this. The only way to that water is forward. Then she looks at her swollen red hands. What's a little fire, anyway? She holds eye contact with me just for a moment, and I know that she's going to make a run for it. She will either reach the water, or the flames will consume her. Either way, this may be the last we will see of each other. I want to say something, but I don't know what to say. Good luck sounds so trite and pointless in the face of this. I guess she feels the same way because she just nods, an acceptance of all things not said, and turns and shuffles down the road. A few more steps and she lifts her feet instead of shuffling. Then she's running. She's actually running. And the last we see of her is her back as she disappears into the smoke. Alyssa, come on, says Garrett. We should have stopped her. We couldn't, Kelton says. And I know he's right. All we have are bad choices left to us now. Jackie made her bad choice. Now we have to make ours. I look to the north. The hillside is steep. I have no strength to climb it. But I will. Somehow, I will.
53. Jackie.
The heat teases my cheeks. It has the power to singe, to sear, to incinerate, but it holds back. Now it just teases. Tickles. It plays with me. The slope changes. The road now heads downhill, and I keep my legs moving because I know that water is just at the base. The others were too short-sighted to see it. They were looking at the fire, but not through it. It blinded them. And now I'll be the one to get the first sip. Hell, they'll be lucky if I don't swallow the whole reservoir by the time they make it there. If they make it there. I may be the only one because I was the only one willing to challenge the fire. I will not look behind me. All that's there is dead forest and smoke. Now the heat pulses around me. Or it's just my heartbeat, but it feels like the relentless churning of a living furnace, a god of fire that must be fed. I trip on a branch and take a nasty fall. The branch is on fire. It has fallen from a tree that's burning above. The tops of the trees around me are all burning, and through the smoke to my left and right, I see walls of flame surging forward, igniting bark on every trunk. The air is cooler down low, but only slightly. The smoke burns my lungs a little less. I pick myself up and run, but stay as crouched as I can, so I'm halfway in the better air. Now my entire body throbs. The heat is done playing, and although the flames still aren't on me, that doesn't matter. I can broil just as quickly as I can burn, so I move faster to beat the pain. The wind whips in every direction, sparks helixing all around me. And that's when I hear it. Jackie. Jackie. It's the gust at my back whispering my name, the burning breeze at my cheeks. The same wind I've always felt my entire life, the call of the void. But now it surges not just before me, but all around me with self-satisfied omnipotence. And for the first time, it actually scares me. I've let the void taunt me and tempt me all my life. I will not let it take me. Finally, with all that is left in me, I will fight back against it. The flames are now surging across the road, completely blocking my path. Every tree is ablaze, but just beyond the sheet of flames, I see something sparkling, twinkling in the firelight. The reservoir. Salvation beyond a veil of hell. They call that purgatory. I can accept purgatory if heaven is beyond it. Jackie. The pain is beyond imagining now, but still I run. I can't keep my eyes open, so I clamp them shut, and when I do, I find myself staring directly into the void. I am barreling through white flame and absolute darkness, the nexus between life and death. The void is beginning to take my body, and I know exactly what comes next. It wants my soul. But it won't get that without a fight. I don't slow down. I don't accept the pain. I crash through the burning void toward the waters of heaven.
54. Alyssa.
The fire chases us uphill. Every time I look back, no matter how far we've climbed, the fire is no farther away, but it's no closer to us either. It's matching our pace, which means we can't slow down, not for an instant, because if we do, it will overtake us. There's a wind now, but it's not coming from behind us. It's blowing against us from the top of the hill. The fire's pulling down air, I think, sucking it in to feed it. I immediately get a vision of the beach, how the incoming waves create an undertow, drawing back the water from the shore. We are caught in that undertow now with a massive wave behind us surging forward, and the image is so powerful and my mind so weakened, I get muddled. The popping sound of boiling sap and the throaty breath of flames blends together into a deep roar that sounds just as ominous as a storm-torn sea. and I think for a moment that I am there at the shore, running from an all-consuming tsunami. It's only when I look at my brother climbing 2 paces ahead of me that I remember what we're doing and where we are. But I wish it were water chasing us, even salt water. If I were at the shore now, I would drink it until it killed me, like any other water zombie. When we began up the hill, the three of us were side by side, but Garrett, the last one to have water, has pulled a few yards ahead, and now Kelton has lagged behind.
When we're at
the top, Kelton wheezes between labored breaths and coughs. We'll
turn left, cut across to the...
He can't find the word.
To the...
reservoir, I finish for him.
Come on,
Garrett yells. He's even farther ahead now, frustrated that we're not keeping up with him.
We're almost there.
But the top of the hill looks like miles and miles to me. I turn to see that Kelton has fallen even farther behind. He leans on a stump now, trying to catch his breath, embers from the fire falling around him like flaming confetti.
Kelton! Just a...
I make my way back to him, halving the distance between me and the fire.
Just a... sec.
It's so hot here, it feels as if my clothes will ignite. It feels like my dry skin will spontaneously combust.
Little rest, says Kelton.
No, I yell. The mention of the word rest makes my knees want to fold. It sounds so, so good. The roar of the waves. Rest. Toes in the cool, cool sand.
No!
I grab Kelton and practically hurl him over the stump.
I gotta,
he mutters.
You gotta move!
I help him off the ground and start his momentum. He has not come this far and seen the things he's seen happen to his family just to falter in these last moments and die. And somehow, putting Kelton at the center of my effort helps me overcome my own desire to drop where I stand. We continue upward, and I realize that this is my burst of energy. The last one I'll have before there's nothing left to give. I hope Kelton appreciates that I used it on him. I can't see Garrett anymore. He's far above us, but I hear him calling my name, and I focus in on that. Until Kelton's legs give out on him again. He's not just leaning and heaving to catch his breath this time. He's on the ground, flat. He can't even push himself up.
Safe room, he says. Get to the safe room.
He's delirious, and there's nothing I can do about that. The thirst has started to shut down his brain. There's only one thing I can think to do. One thing that might get his lifeless legs moving again.
I'm not letting you stay here, I scream at him. Which means if you don't get your ass up that hill, I die too.
Is that what you want? You want me to die because of you? His roomy eyes meet mine. An ember falls beside him, setting the dry grass on fire. He pushes himself up on all fours. He scrambles forward. It worked. Putting me at the forefront of his thoughts drew out what little energy he had left, just as when I had focused on helping him. And I realize that this is the true core of human nature. When we've lost the strength to save ourselves, we somehow find the strength to save each other. We finally reach the crest of the hill. I find it hard to believe I'm still alive. I don't feel it. I feel like I died 100 yards downhill, and now my spirit is trapped here, doomed to haunt this place, reliving the climb
and the thirst, and the flames for all eternity. Garrett stands on a flat boulder, still out of breath, looking west. I join him. From this high vantage point, we can see the reservoir. It's maybe only a quarter mile below us. Kelton was right. He was right. But the fire has snuck in, insidious, determined. It now rages at full force between us and the reservoir. How could the water be so close and us still be unable to reach it? North, I say, around it. The words barely come out. My tongue is a piece of leather in my mouth, my vocal cords brittle paper. We can still head north and get past the fire. Climbing the hill was the hard part. Downhill will be easier, won't it? We can still loop around the fire and double back to the reservoir. But then I look to Kelton. He's lying face down in the dust. No! I make my way to him. I roll him over. I can't hear him breathing over the roar of the approaching flames. So I force his eyes open, as if seeing his eyes will mean that he sees mine. Kelton! Wake up! Finally, he begins mumbling, but it's not words. It's just guttural sounds, faint clicks and hisses. His eyes roll into his head, and I know that he's just a few minutes away from dying. And I know that I can't stop it. And I know that Garrett and I can't carry him, no matter how hard we try. Alyssa? I turn to Garrett, who has taken a few steps down the other side of the hill. North. The direction we have to go if we want to live. But when I join him there, I see what he sees, and it makes everything as clear as the water we can't get to. There isn't a slope on that side of the hill. There's a cliff, a sheer drop, at least 50 feet. There's no way down but the way we came, which means we're cornered. Garrett looks at me with such despair, it nearly overwhelms me. I see him begin to sway and waver. His shoulders go a little limp. Whatever energy he had left has been stolen from him by this revelation. I quickly grab him and pull him back from the ledge before he can swoon off the cliff, and I hold him tight. It's going to be okay, I tell him. No, it's not, he says weakly. You know it's not. I do know, but I won't confess it. Not to him. Instead, I lead him back to the flat boulder. It looks like an altar, a place where our hope was sacrificed. Garrett turns away from me, brings his knees to his chest, pulling himself into a ball. He looks toward the reservoir and the water we almost reached. That's the image he wants to hold in his mind now. Not his life, not our family. The memory of water. The sound of the approaching fire is deafening now. The sky above us darkens with smoke, like night falling early. Suddenly, I know what I have to do. I've heard that the worst way to die is by fire. I will not go that way if I don't have to. And I will not let my brother be burned alive. So I pull out the gun that has been shoved uncomfortably in my waist ever since Kelton gave it to me. I almost wanted to leave it in the truck. I almost chucked it when we started up the hill, because it was so cumbersome. But something told me not to. Never in my life have I been so horrified, and yet so happy to be holding a loaded gun. I hide it so Garrett doesn't see, and he lets me put my other arm around him. He leans into me. He sobs, but no tears come out. I want to go home, Garrett says. I want it to be last week. So do I tell him. Was it only just a week ago? Downhill, a burning tree falls with an explosion of embers that sail skyward over our heads. Seeds to spread the fire elsewhere. I bring the gun to Garrett's head, but not close enough to touch, because I don't want him to know. I love you, Garrett, I tell him, and he echoes it back. It's the thing brothers and sisters never say to each other until they find themselves in a moment where nothing else can possibly be said. Then I grip the trigger, feeling the gun's weight. But I hesitate, and hesitate some more. And then Garrett says, in the faintest of whispers, "Do it, Alyssa." He doesn't look at me. He doesn't want to see the gun or me. So I press the muzzle against that space between his ear and his eye, where the hair is short and soft. Do it, please. I will be strong. If not for me, then for Garrett. I will save him from the flames, and then I will save Kelton, and then I will save myself.
Snapshot. Los Angeles Fire Department. Bombardier 415. The water bomber glides just meters above the lake. Like a pelican, it swoops down gently, slicing the tips of little wakes until its open bill is fully submerged, scooping nearly 1,000 gallons, all within seconds. The pilot and his seabird have made this trip countless times in these last couple of days. He was given direct orders by his tactical supervisor to fill up at the San Gabriel Reservoir and make water drops on the fires between here and Lake Arrowhead, 20 miles east. The blazes that block the path to Big Bear Lake have already claimed countless lives. He can't do anything about that, but at least with the fires threatening the road to Arrowhead, he can make a difference. The pilot pitches the nose of the seabird up from the reservoir basin, and together they soar. He gapes at the fires surrounding the reservoir, surprised they've grown this far. Sometimes when a brush fire grows out of control, fire authorities set a backfire, a controlled burn that hedges the amount of destruction a wildfire may cause. But this fire doesn't seem to be one of those, he notes, getting closer. This is the real thing. But he's only here for the water. They'll set another battalion to work here. Right now, it's a lower priority. His drop point is much farther east. Putting out these fires is beginning to feel like a never-ending game of whack-a-mole. Or at least that's how he tries to see it. It's easier that way. Every time he makes a trip to refill from the reservoir, he has to fly past an overcrowded evacuation center. Each time he sees all of those people there, fenced in and helpless, he's had half a mind to just drop the entire payload of water on them. But that's an insufficient use of resources. He can save more lives by dousing fires. So he's been choosing to fly a little higher, above that evac center. High enough that people look like ants. It's an attempt to set a backfire to his own empathy. Whatever it takes to prevent his conscience from burning him alive. But now, as he leaves the reservoir, he sees something odd. It looks like there's someone running through the fire. The plane had just done a steep climb from the reservoir basin. Maybe it's just his imagination or a head rush from the climb. But just to be sure, the pilot banks left, doubling back to get a better look. And sure enough, someone is sprinting through the flames. A girl. What is she doing out here? What possessed her to challenge a forest fire? Then his eyes are drawn to the top of a bluff, where he sees others. They're trapped against the edge of a cliff, the fire burning toward them. He weighs his options. He reaches deep. This is not his drop zone. His orders are very specific. Yet even though he's already begun his ascent, he realizes he can't just let this go. He's flown too low to jettison his humanity.
55. Alyssa.
My finger is firmly curled on the trigger when the deafening wail of the flames gives way to a scream. No, not a scream. Something else. I know that sound. It grows into an ear-splitting mechanical resonance that changes pitch as a shadow passes overhead. Then suddenly the billowing smoke is shredded by something cold and wet. It falls upon us in a single massive deluge that only lasts for a couple of seconds, but it's enough to drench us, to soak the ground and to wound the fire. I hurl the gun to the ground. Instantly, it has become my enemy. I lick my hands. I lick my arms. I bunch my hair, pull it around, and suck on it. Water! It tastes of ash, but I don't care. I swallow. My throat screams in pain, but I swallow again and again. Garrett is on his knees, licking the boulder, catching tiny rivulets that course down its side. And then I see that there are dips and indentations on the surface of the flat stone, spots where the water has pooled. I push my face into one of the shallow basins so hard I nearly break my nose. I draw the water in. Then I realize there's something I've forgotten. Someone. I tear myself away to look at Kelton. He hasn't moved. His sneakers are still smoking. The flames had been that close to him. But now the fire has retreated about a dozen feet. White steam now belches forth, blending with the black smoke as the fire licks its wounds. I dip my hands into one of the indentations in the rock, scooping up water, but I barely get any. The pool is not deep enough. Still, I try to carry what I have to Kelton, but it dribbles through my fingers and is gone by the time I reach him. I can't bring it to him this way. I must find another way. When the answer comes, I almost laugh at myself at how simple it is. And yet a week ago, I would never have considered such a thing. The box I lived in was simply too small to think that far out of it. I go back to the boulder and once again push my face down into the largest pool, sucking in a mouthful of water. But as much as my body wants me to swallow, I don't. I hold it, and I hurry to Kelton. I get down on my knees, leaning over him. I pull his mouth open with one hand and press my lips against his. Then I force the water out into his mouth, giving him a different kind of resuscitation. I pull my mouth away, push his jaw closed, and wait. Nothing. And nothing. And then a gargle and a cough. Water shoots up out of his mouth like a fountain, but I put my hand over his mouth and force it closed. Let him gag. Let him choke. But let him swallow. He writhes weakly, gagging on the water, forcing it out of his lungs, and with nowhere else to go, it pools in his throat again, and I see his Adam's apple go up and go down. He's swallowed. I run back to the boulder, draw in all the rest of the water that's pooled there, and go back to Kelton again. His eyes are slightly open. He's faintly aware. Once more, I press my mouth to his and force the water out. This time, he brings his hand up, gently holding my shoulder. I feel him actively sucking the water from me, and I let him until I can feel him swallow. Then I let him go and lean back to catch my breath. He looks at me, still only halfway conscious. The moment is ripe for some sly remark, but we're both beyond that kind of thing now.
Rain? He asks.
Plain, I tell him.
Even better.
Then he rolls over on his side, coughing, but that's fine. He can cough as much as he wants now. I look to the fire that still rages, but for the moment is at bay. Garrett now lies face up and sprawled out on the boulder, looking to the hazy blue sky. We could die happy now, our thirst finally quenched. But maybe we won't be dying today. Kelton sits up. He's sucking on his sleeve, getting all the water he can from it. And I decide to do the same to my sleeve. Meanwhile, I watch as the plane returns to the lake, skimming water from its surface, filling up for a second run.
Part 6. A New Normal. Snapshot. Disneyland. 8:57 a.m. Saturday, June 25th. Main Street has been washed clean of wildfire ash. The haunted mansion has been cleared of vagrants, and the green phalluses spray-painted on the beloved character mural have all been scrubbed off. It's been almost 2 weeks since the tap-out officially ended, and it's taken that long to get things up and running again. Not just here, but all over Southern California. But the Magic Kingdom is at the forefront of the effort to restore life as we knew it. With so many cast members not returning, there are a lot of new hirees, including an 18-year-old ticket taker at the front gate whose mother forced him to take a summer job. The recent catastrophe cost the family a fortune in insurance deductibles. Everyone is expected to contribute. "It'll be fun," she said. But it hasn't been. Instead, it's kind of been like finding out that the Tooth Fairy doesn't exist, or catching Santa smoking cigarettes in the Macy's parking lot. Perhaps it's because the entire park has looked practically post-apocalyptic. No character costumes, no electrical parade, no jazz band in New Orleans Square, and no guests. This has been the longest closure since the park was built. There was simply too much damage to repair, too much infrastructure to rebuild. Not just here, but everywhere. There was looting here, but not as much as one might think. People didn't care about clothing or technology. There was only one thing they were looking for. Food concessions were torn apart searching for that one thing. The one remaining water feature in the park, a fountain in Tomorrowland, had become a mecca for lost souls who drank the chlorinated water until it was gone. The spin doctors in the corporate offices are planning to rebrand it the Fountain of Life. The big news being pushed is that nobody died in the park, and that's saying a lot. There's probably no other geographic area as large that can make that claim. Tons of people are being heralded as heroes all over Southern California, like the power plant manager who quelled a riot in Huntington Beach, and the mysterious Good Samaritan in Tustin who saved a whole bunch of people at a nursing home, then disappeared. The ticket taker would like to say he himself was a hero, but he didn't do much of anything beyond survive. That was hard enough. 8:58 a.m. He stands at his spot at the turnstiles, counting down the minutes until Disneyland opens up again, marking the first official day of normalcy. On the other side of the Emerald Gates, the lines wind out of sight, and he realizes why people are here, why they need to be here. More than 200,000 souls perished during humanity's hiatus, the highest fatality count from any non-war event in the history of the nation. Yet even that number somehow feels remarkably low. And the fact that it isn't higher is a miracle. Or at least that's what people have been reaching for. The silver lining. Why else would so many need to be in the one place where magic still exists, where hope is eternal, where dreams never die? The clock strikes 9. The music fades in right on cue, enchanting the crowd, and then the sparkling emerald gates open, welcoming humanity back to the happiest place on earth. Fifty-six. Alyssa.
Soapy sponge, wet washcloth, dry towel, repeat. A pounding at the bathroom door.
Alyssa, come on already, says Garrett. I gotta take a dump.
Soapy sponge, wet washcloth, dry towel, repeat.
Use the downstairs bathroom.
I can't. Dad's in there. The sponge, the washcloth, the towel, one arm, one leg at a time. I will get clean. It will just take a little effort.
Garrett pounds again. What are you even doing in there?
I'm taking a shower.
I don't hear the shower running.
Then you're deaf.
He's not deaf. The shower is not on. But there's a sponge for soaping, a washcloth for rinsing, and a towel for drying. I stand in the shower and reach over to the sink, which is half filled with warm water, like a basin in the days before homes had running water. With the water heater finally replaced, we don't have to boil water to warm it anymore. And with our neighborhood's water turned on for 2 days a week, it means we can shower. I know that.
but I just can't do it. I can't bring myself to spray my body and watch it flow down the drain. Maybe another day, but not today. Today, it's a sponge, a washcloth, and a towel. I'm happy with that. More than happy. I'm satisfied. We'll be leaving soon, I call out to Garrett. Are you ready to go? I'm ready to use the bathroom. The crisis officially ended 2 weeks ago, just a day after Kelton, Garrett, and I were airlifted out of the forest and dropped off at Lake Arrowhead, where the entire community had become one massive evacuation center. But only for the people who managed to get there, which wasn't easy. We were treated for smoke inhalation. My lungs hurt for a week. They're better now. I dry my hair, put on a robe, and let Garrett into the bathroom, where he starts taking care of business even before I completely vacate. Typical. And yet nothing feels typical anymore. There's a new normal, because our lives are punctuated by weird air pockets of the surreal. Like when we went back to Costco, the shelves were restocked as if nothing ever happened, with a stupid sign out front that said, "Yes, we have water." But even though the store is the same, people are not. Since the return of life as we knew it, I've found there are four kinds of people now, all easy to spot, especially in the aisles of Costco. There are the oblivious ones, who go about their lives like the tap out was a dream that waking life has completely washed away. Maybe they got out before it got bad, or maybe they just exist in a constant state of denial. I find them hard to relate to. It's like talking to aliens pretending to be human. Then there are the ones like us, who lived through it, and are still facing the PTSD of it all. They linger in the aisles, marveling at the sheer magnitude of products and the organization it took to get it all here, no longer taking anything for granted, and guarding their carts as if their lives depended on it. Then there are the fulfilled ones, the people who found something in themselves they didn't know was there, heroes in the rough. Now they talk to strangers, look for opportunities to help. They've discovered they can truly be of use and don't want that to stop just because the crisis is over. I admire them. The tap out left them with a calling they didn't have before. And finally, there are the shadows. These are the ones who move through the aisles silently, avoiding eye contact, afraid at every step that someone will recognize them and accuse them of whatever horrible, unspeakable thing they did to survive. The ones who can't look at others because they can't face themselves. It's the same at school. We all went back a couple of days ago. Even though school would have ended by now, they have to finish the year. Healthy closure, they said. Because a water zombie apocalypse is not truly over until kids go back to school. Three teachers had perished. Two beloved, the third not so much, but everyone cried for him, even so. 38 students were lost, including the school's star running back and the girl voted most likely to succeed. But those weren't the only empty chairs. There were dozens upon dozens who simply hadn't come back and might never come back. My friend Sophia, for one. Who knows if I'll ever see her again? And the shadows were there, too. Kids who are wraiths of their former selves. Hallie Hartling, for instance, who kicked hard, lived large, and was always at the top of the social pyramid. Now she moves quietly through the hallways, and I suspect has completely lost her edge on the soccer field. I suppose I could have become a shadow, because I did plenty of things I am not proud of. But I made the choice to wear it, not as a brand of shame, but as a badge of honor. If I'm scarred, then they are war wounds, and I will not cower from them. When it comes down to it, There's nothing normal about our new environment, and I wonder if life will ever be the same. Will we ever be able to put the past behind us? Will the shadows find redemption? Will all the fulfilled heroes go back to their less altruistic selves? And will I ever stop having nightmares about my parents? It doesn't help that the truth was almost as awful as a night terror. Mom got knocked out during the riot at the beach. She collapsed, out cold against the hot sand. The crowd was savage. She was trampled. 3 of her ribs were broken. Her left lung was punctured, and she suffered a grade 3 concussion. She was lucky that there were still paramedics around to bring her to a hospital, or else she would have died. Dad was arrested because he was fighting to get to Mom, and it got bundled with all the rest of the violent behavior of the mob. Turns out they both ended up in the perfect places. The hospital was a high-priority location, so it got the first water deliveries, and the county jail, being a government facility, never had its water shut off like all the municipal water districts had. Funny that jail was one of the safest places to be. It was hard on Dad, though, not knowing what happened to us or to Mom, not to mention whatever craziness went on in there. He won't talk about it. I don't blame him. They both got home before we did and suffered their own hell waiting to find out what had become of us. But we finally got in touch with them, and they met us where the buses bringing people back from Arrowhead dropped everyone off. It's a moment I replay over and over again in my mind, although the memory registers more viscerally than visually. The feeling of the memory. Maybe because my eyes were too blurred by tears to see much of anything. The feeling of home in the smell of my mother's shirt as I cried into her shoulder. The sense of safety brought by the touch of my father's hand when he rubbed my back to comfort me, just as he did when I was little. The blanket of comfort that was carried by their voices. Voices I thought I might never hear again. We all just stood there in a parking lot, I don't even remember where, holding each other until nearly everyone else had left. I wasn't even embarrassed. I could have stood there and held them till the end of time. Uncle Basil's back with us too, alive and well, just as we told ourselves he would be. We're determined to start calling him Uncle Herb more, although he has his own ideas about that. "Call me Uncle Sage," he told us, "because I feel a whole lot wiser than before." I'm sorry to say that Daphne didn't make it. He still tears up when he talks about it. I really think they loved each other. But our uncle, who had been wallowing in his misfortune for so long after losing his farm up north, isn't wallowing anymore. He's found a second wind in life, selling, of all things, Agua Viva. He's even doing a commercial for them. "Agua Viva saved my life." Talk about turning lemons into lemonade. I joined my mom in the living room to watch the news. It's a press conference. It seems every 5 minutes there's another press conference. "The governor of Arizona just resigned," Mom tells me. No surprise there. Everyone who had a part in shutting off the flow of the Colorado River into California is facing criminal prosecution. Officials are being indicted on everything from criminal negligence to conspiracy to commit murder. "And," Mom says, "they finally found the Good Samaritan who saved all those people in that nursing home." "There were lots of Good Samaritans," I point out, thinking of the water angel and the pilot who dropped water on our fire and that rabbi and the priest who both led thousands of people on a pilgrimage to the promised land of Big Bear Lake just before fires closed in behind them, blocking the way for others. "Yes, well, there can never be too many good deed doers," Mom says. I glance at her to see that she's taken the bandage off her forehead. 7 stitches. They don't look as bad as I thought they would. At the sound of running water, I glance into the kitchen. Garrett has come downstairs and is filling Kingston's water bowl. He does this every day now, something he never did when Kingston was actually here. Now he sets it outside every morning with food. Some days he goes off alone, riding his bike in the hills, looking for our dog. "He'll come back," Garrett says, "when he thinks it's safe. He'll come back." I want to believe that. I want to believe that maybe someone else found him and has given him a new home. Dad offered to get us a new dog. "A rescue," he said. "Maybe a dog whose owner died in the tap-out and needs a family like ours." But Garrett won't have it. As if taking in a new dog is some sort of admission that Kingston's gone for good. After Garrett fills up the bowl, he turns off the water, but then turns it on again, watching the faucet, watching the water flow down the drain. Then he turns it off, then turns it on, then turns it off, then on, over and over. I should be mad that he's wasting water. After all, we still have all the same restrictions as before. No watering lawns, no frivolous use. But I'm not mad at Garrett, because I know this is not about him intentionally wasting water. It's that he's mesmerized by it, not by the water itself, but by the sheer power to be able to make it flow and make it stop with the simple flick of the wrist. He catches me watching him and looks away, a bit red-faced, caught in his private guilty moment. "Ready to go?" I ask him. "I've thought about it," Garrett says, "and I decided I'm not gonna go." "You sure?" I ask him. "You might regret it later." "Yeah, I might," he admits, "but I'm sure." He leaves so he doesn't have to talk about it anymore. I'm not going to pressure him. If he doesn't want to come, he doesn't have to. So it will just be me and Kelton. And a few minutes later, Kelton arrives, barging in unannounced, which has become a fairly normal occurrence. He's actually been crashing on the couch here some nights. He's got his reasons, and they're all good ones. I don't mind him around.
"Turn on the TV," Kelton insists.
"Already on," I point out.
"You've got to see this."
He grabs the remote and switches around until he lands on a different news station. And on the screen is a face I thought I'd never see again. We're looking at none other than Henry Not Roycroft being interviewed by a reporter. Henry, larger than life on my TV. I always thought jaw-dropping was figurative, but my jaw actually does drop.
"Oh, look," says my mom. "This is what I was talking about. That's the Good Samaritan."
The caption reads, "Henry Groin."
"Groin?
His last name is Groin?" Henry speaks proudly. "I just did what anyone would do." Not everyone would run into a burning building with nothing but a towel over his head to rescue people, says the reporter.
"That was in Tustin," I yell at the TV. "He was nowhere near Tustin."
"Shush," Mom says. "I want to hear this." On screen, Henry shrugs like he hasn't just taken credit for something he couldn't possibly have done.
"In this life, you see what must be accomplished, weigh your options, and then embrace the opportunity."
"But why did you wait so long to come forward?"
"It's not about me. It's about the people I saved."
"You've got to be kidding me," I shout.
"It gets worse," says Kelton, who must have already seen this on another station.
Now the report cuts back to the studio, where the anchor smiles for the camera and says, "Henry is an eighth grader at Access Alternative Middle School, proving that you're never too young to be a hero."
"What? He's a what? He's in eighth grade?
He does look a bit old for his age, though, Mom says, cheerfully oblivious. There isn't even a word for how utterly speechless I feel. He said he was driving since he was 13.
Yeah, says Kelton, which was like 3 months ago.
My mom looks at us as if we just arrived from Mars.
What are you two talking about?
And since neither of us wants to spiral down the rabbit hole of this particular madness, we excuse ourselves and go outside. Kelton and I grumble and moan about it, trying to filter our whole experience with Henry through this new lens, and decide it's not worth it. So we end up laughing about it, and choose to move on. And pretty soon, Kelton will be moving on too, one way or another. There's a big for sale sign on Kelton's lawn, a lawn that you can actually see now since the security gate was rammed down during the not-so-neighborly neighbor attack. How are things? I ask him. I know it's a loaded question.
Good, Kelton says. I'm breathing. That's a thing. And it's good.
There's a silence that lingers between us, but it means something now. What? I'm not sure. Kelton's parents are splitting up. He says it was inevitable. He almost seems relieved. His mom already moved out and took an apartment a few miles away.
My mom wants me to live with her, Kelton tells me.
Do you want to?
Well, it's either that or go with my dad to live with his sister in Idaho.
The one with all the cats?
Yeah. He looks off toward his house. I can't imagine what it must be like staying there now. How could you cook in that kitchen with a memory of what happened there? How could you sit at that table? It makes sense that they're selling, although I don't know how much luck they'll have. Too many homes have for sale signs now. My dad got rid of all the guns, Kelton tells me. He didn't sell them. He destroyed them. Every last one. Part of his way of mourning Brady, I guess. I don't think he'll touch one for the rest of his life. I think to my own brief ballistic history, right after those men attacked us in the woods, how I took Kelton's pistol and how I was fully prepared to use it. How I almost did use it to end our lives. I don't even know what happened to the gun after that. I hope it was destroyed, too. Anyway, I'll stay with my dad until he heads to Idaho, Kelton tells me. He kind of needs me more than my mom does right now. It might not look it, but my mom's the strong one. I nod. I get that. We sit down on my lawn, looking across the street at the Kibblers, who are supervising their kids as they play Mame the Sibling or some similar game in the street. Kelton and I will be leaving in about 20 minutes, when my dad gets back because he's driving us, but knowing him, he'll be late, what with all the new business. Before the tap out, he was struggling, but now the insurance biz has seen a fresh surge. Suddenly, everyone wants disaster insurance. Go figure.
We're not making money off of people's misfortunes, my father is constantly reminding himself and us. We're protecting people from future misfortunes.
As we wait on my lawn, which is still brown and will never be spray-painted green, Kelton turns to me and asks me a question.
So, like, what are we? He asks.
I shrug.
Survivors, I tell him.
No, I mean, what are we to each other?
Oh, that.
This feels like it should be an awkward conversation, and yet it's not awkward at all, which makes me realize exactly what we are to each other. We're old friends who've known each other for, like, 100 years, I tell him. It's just that 95 of them happened in 1 week. Kelton smiles.
I like that.
But then his smile fades, His eyes seem to be looking far off, past the Kibler's feral children, past our neighborhood entirely. His eyes become moist. I killed people, Alyssa. I've been waiting for him to say something about that. Waiting for 2 weeks. I'm glad he finally said it, so I can tell him what I've wanted to all this time. You did what you had to do, and that's all. We all did what we had to do, and that's the end of it. Besides, the forest burned, Kelton. There's nothing left, so no one's ever going to know. But I know. So do I. And you know what? I forgive you. Then I add, I forgive you for that more than I forgive you for the thing with the drone. That makes him smile again. Your priorities are way out of whack, Miss Morrow. I lean over sideways and bump his shoulder. He bumps me back. Then he looks at me for a moment, pondering, considering. 3 years from now, he says, when you break up with your first college boyfriend, you'll call me and I'll stay up all night talking you through it. Possibly, I admit, and then I say, 7 years from now, when your first computer startup company goes belly up, we'll go out that night. I'll make you laugh and keep you from getting too drunk and convince you to get to work on your second tech startup. Possibly, he admits. And 12 years from now, you'll call to tell me that you want me to be the godfather to your first kid. Possibly, I concede. And 20 years from now, we'll all go on vacation together, and our spouses, or whatever, will get jealous that we're spending too much time talking to each other, and they'll run off together. Possibly, he concludes. And 30 years from now, when you're running for re-election, and I've made my third fortune, I'll take you dancing, and it'll be all over the tabloids. And then he adds, of course, they'll be holographic by then. I have to laugh. Of course they will. He smiles at me. And then, maybe we can ask again, what are we to each other? I hold out my hand to shake. It's a date. But instead of shaking it, he takes my hand and kisses it, like someone who is actually charming. And I think, yeah, he might get to charming one of these days. Wow, he says. I finally have a date with Alyssa Morrow. I can die happy. We both laugh, and it feels comfortable. It feels real. And it makes me feel a little sad that we might not get to dance together for 30 years. Dad pulls up, amazingly, on time. You both ready to go? He asks. Never been more ready, I tell him. You see, just yesterday, when I got home from school, my mom looked at me strangely, which she's been doing a lot of lately, but this time there was a clear reason. I just got the oddest call, Mom said. There's this girl at a burn unit way out at Foothill Hospital, and the weird thing is, she gave your name as her emergency contact. I think they might have the wrong Alyssa Morrow. I know for a fact that there are 5 Alyssa Morrows in California. I know for a fact that they found the right one. And it doesn't surprise me that Jackie kicked the fire's ass. Kelton opens the door for me, but trips on the curb as he does, which is perfect. In fact, I'd have it no other way. We get in and set out on our familiar, unfamiliar street and head off into a world where fresh roots are already growing deep in the fertile ruins of what used to be. Wasn't it Jackie who told us the human body is 60% water? Well, now I know what the rest is. The rest is dust. The rest is ash. It's sorrow and it's grief. But above all that, In spite of all that, binding us together is hope and joy, and a wellspring of all the things that still might be.
Dry was written by Neil and Jared Schusterman. Alyssa was read by Jenny Barber. Kelton by Noah Galvin. Jackie by Candace Thaxton. Henry by Michael Crouch. Garrett by Kivligan de Montebello. The narrators were Neil and Jared Schusterman. It was recorded at Simon & Schuster Studios in New York, Dave & Dave Recording Studios in Los Angeles, Stage One Inc. in Laguna Hills, California, and In Your Ear Studios in Richmond, Virginia. The recording engineers were Brianna Villarreal, Rick Dasher, Ethan Donaldson, Noriko Okabe, and Robert Elfazi. Editing by Christina Pichano and Ethan Donaldson. Post-production by Hudson Sound. The associate producer was Aaron Larson. Dry was produced and directed by Karen Perlman. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Dry is available in print from Simon & Schuster Books for Young Readers.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.